thegameshow.com/blog. We'd love to get a response from you on there. Thanks to Billy Shears, music director. Don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Later, gang.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop, all the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There's a lot going on in the news this week, and I've been focusing on some of my really incredible guests that I've had both last week and this week, so I haven't had a chance just to sit and talk with you about the various news of the week. Before we get to that, I do want to tell you about what's coming up this week, because, yes, I've got another string of terrific guests for you, and I want to brag about it and also encourage you to tune in the rest of the week. Tomorrow night, we're going to go over taxes. After all, it is April 15th. It is a time when Americans are always thinking about taxes, and I'll be arguing with a conservative again. This time, Catherine Rasmussen of the National Taxpayers Union, and we'll talk about all kinds of taxes. So as you finish up your returns tomorrow, you might want to tune into that program. And then Wednesday's really the highlight of the week. Wednesday's the thing I'll be bragging about for some time to come. Colonel Larry Wilkerson, the chief of staff to Colin Powell when he was Secretary of State. That's right. The colonel who has spoken out most vociferously against the war in Iraq. The person who was in there in the early years when they made all these decisions. This guy was in the room. This guy was skeptical then. Frankly, I think Colin Powell was fairly skeptical. I still have some criticism for the man for staying in and trying to fix it instead of coming out and telling us all that was going wrong. But at least compared to the rest of the administration, which is not saying much, Colin Powell is a man with principles. In any case, Larry Wilkerson, Colonel Wilkerson, will be coming on the show Wednesday. Truly, truly a special honor to talk with me, to talk with you about the early decisions of the Iraq War, what went right, if anything, what went wrong, where we made the wrong decisions, and what he thinks of General Petraeus today. And I want to talk with you today about General Petraeus and his strategy for doing nothing in Iraq. We'll get to that. And then Thursday, I've got members of Congress, two Democratic congressmen who will talk about the Democratic response. You want a chance to take on a Democratic member of Congress, to tell them why, ask them why they're not doing enough to stop the war, and that'll be your chance on Thursday. So got a lot of good shows in the pipe for you, and I want you to check those out. This week, there's, of course, the one of the things I guess that most drew my eye was the polygamous compound in Texas. And I had to think about what I thought was the government's role, what was right, what was wrong. Clearly it was right to go in when a child was being abused. But I want to talk about that and also the context just of religion in America. After all, we have the Pope coming to visit, and that will be interesting as well. There are the Petraeus hearings. I didn't get to finish talking about that last week. We've got General Petraeus' strategy, which basically is hold, wait, and hope. His strategy appears to be that if we're having trouble in Iraq, we need more troops. And if we're doing well in Iraq, we need more troops. And either way, we'll be in Iraq for the next 100 years. No wonder that General Petraeus is representing the Bush administration. And then I want to talk about spying and interrogation. Because, to me, the memo of my former classmate at Yale, John Yoo, has gotten far too little attention. I mean, we've always known it existed. I've talked about it before. But then it came out, and it was a yawn. And now we know, as if there were any doubt, but we know, in effect, as a fact now, that George Bush approved torture. Now, you know, we've talked about it on this show before, and we've said these things, and before then we've always had, you know, I invite right-winger Mike Lane to come on, and he says, well, you know, it all depends on what the definition of torture is, blah, 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 blah. And maybe George Bush didn't approve it, and maybe Abu Ghraib was just an exception. Well, now we have the proof. Now that George Bush is convinced that everyone knows he ordered torture, he finally admitted it. He finally admitted that each and every one of the severe interrogations, including, yes, water torture, the technique that brings us back to the Inquisition, the technique that, of course, Americans were court-martialed for in 1898, that Japanese were killed for, got the death penalty for doing it to Americans in World War II, the president ordered it himself. But it is a week in review, so any topic you want to bring up is valid. You can feel free to give a call, 877-4HEAD-ON. This is a real good day to call, folks, because without a guest, we have plenty of time just to talk and say whatever's on your mind. 877-443-2366. I want to start with the polygamy issue in Texas, because it really raises interesting questions for me. I really think the issue is not polygamy. The issue is forcing 16-year-old children against their will to submit to rape and violence. You see, I have a little bit of a problem with that. Forcing a 16-year-old against her will to submit to rape. That's a problem. The problem is not polygamy. And the interesting thing is that that's what, of course, all the commentators are focusing on, because we all like to look at strange religious teachings, shall we say. And, of course, the polygamy is one of them. When you've got a offshoot of the old Mormon church down in Texas in a holy compound, and they're marrying hundreds of girls to a guy, there is a problem. But I want to focus on exactly what the problem is, because I think it's very important that we make this distinguishing point. Because in general, I think that people should have the liberty, consenting adults should have the liberty to do whatever they please. If consenting adults aren't harming anybody, we'll leave them alone, right? Now, and I'm not talking about incest. I mean, there you've got a really strange thing where you have someone raising someone else, and then that's not cool. Not cool, because then you have all kinds of psychological pressure and so forth. But when you have two strangers, consenting adults, for example, let's say in my hypothetical example, we've got one man and two women, and none of them are related, and they're all 30 years old, and they want to be a triple instead of a couple. Or, for that matter, two men and one woman. Or, for that matter, three men or three women. If three consenting adults who are strangers to each other want to live as a family unit, would I prohibit it? No, of course not. That's, you know, people can do what they want to do. If they even have a religious ceremony that is structured by their religion, is that okay with me? It is. Now, should they get the same benefits as marriage? I think not, but my justification is not based on the fact that this is immoral or wrong, or that the government should be intervening in someone else's morality. But they shouldn't, because, heck, we all get benefits for two in America. That doesn't mean we should get benefits for three. It's sort of an equality under the law issue. I mean, if you have worked hard and gotten Social Security benefits, I think your spouse should be able to get those benefits if you die or on disability. And that spouse could be a significant other, could be a gay couple, could be two people who've lived in love for many years, no matter what their sex. I get that. But you don't make it 3 or 4 or 12 or 26, because that's not equal. That's not equality under the law. And so I think you can make a distinction. So should three people get the same equal benefits, which is actually more benefits than two people in a committed relationship? No, I don't think so. And I think that's a fair distinction. I don't think I'm being discriminatory in saying so. But at the same time, if three people want to have some ceremony under their religious teaching that gives them committed to each other, and they're adults and they're not related, fine. Not my problem, not my issue. I'm not going to intervene in someone's sex life. But what happened in Texas is not that. And that's why I guess I don't like polygamy to be the question. What went on in Texas was no less than child rape and torture and incest, an incest of the worst kind, where you have people raising each other and then forcibly marrying each other, including a 16-year-old who was forced to marry a 50-year-old and forced to submit to sex with him. That's something different. That's child abuse. In fact, there was even a question today, it's sort of a separate question, but I thought it was interesting because I thought of this polygamy case, of whether child rape should be subject to the death penalty. And it's an interesting issue. Generally, the only thing that is subject to the death penalty is murder. It's the only crime that is subject to the death penalty, and some of us would argue that really only mass murder should be subject to the death penalty. And again, I want to separate issues of practicality from ideology on the death penalty. I think that there's a big difference between saying, well, it's unfair the way the death penalty is practiced in America today, which I completely agree with. If you're poor, you're more likely to get the death penalty. If you're black, you're more likely to get the death penalty. If you live in Texas, you're more likely to get the death penalty than if you live in other states. It's not fairly applied across the board. People who can afford good lawyers don't usually get the death penalty. So I have a real trouble with the unequal application of it. But in terms of strict ideology, in terms of saying that if you willfully and intentionally murder someone, and assuming that we could necessarily know that there are no mistakes made, and that's another huge problem with the death penalty, right? Because, oops, you make a mistake, there's no way out of it. But let's say we have a confession and 100 witnesses, and, you know, I think of people like, Timothy McVeigh, or the Long Island Railroad shooter, or frankly, Osama bin Laden, or the guy, I can't remember his name, I don't want to know his name, but the one who I remember in San Francisco took Asian children, separated them from the non-Asian children and shot them, or the one that killed the Amish kids recently, or, of course, Cho, although I think Cho was crazy in Virginia Tech. Mass murders, I really have no problem if he hadn't killed himself from having the death penalty there. And, you know, if you disagree, call in, let me know why. Let's talk about it. But the interesting question is coming up of child rape. Should a non-murder be subject to the death penalty? And I don't know. Not that I have any sympathy whatsoever for someone who rapes a child. Clearly they should get at least life imprisonment. And, you know, I don't know that I even have a real problem with the death penalty, except for the fact that it leads to bad consequences. You have to look at it not as, do I want revenge for this evil person, but what are the consequences of such a death penalty? And let's think of two. One consequence is if a person is raping a child, and he, and it's almost always a he, I could say he or she, but, you know, the cases of a woman raping a child are, what, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000? I'm not talking about statutory rape here. I'm not talking about those, you know, women and you know, young women teaching school who have sex with their 16-year-olds. No, I'm talking about real forcible rape, violent forced rape. And I can't think of hardly any examples of a woman doing that. So I'm going to use the pronoun he. If a man is raping a child forcibly against the child's will, and he knows that he will get the death penalty for the crime, isn't he more likely to kill the child? Isn't he more likely to say, well, if I get the death penalty either way, I might as well kill the witness? It's an awful, awful thing, but you have to think not just about revenge, but about what's the best policy. You have to look and say, which is better to save more children? And in this case, actually, I think not having the death penalty for child rape could save a child's life. It also, I think, leads to less reporting. If you have the death penalty, many of these crimes are incestuous. Many of these crimes are like the polygamous compound in El Paso, Texas. You have some 50-year-old who's a cousin of the 16-year-old, or an uncle, or often is not, a stepfather. Actually, stepfathers are often the ones that are committing these crimes, sometimes a biological father. And a child is far less likely to report such a gruesome crime if it will lead to the death penalty. So I think that the death penalty should stick with murder. I think we can have life imprisonment for all kinds of other crimes, but we'll save taking someone's life for only the act of taking someone's life. But heck, you know, if you disagree or agree, call in, let me know. I just thought it was an interesting question because they're raising it now before the United States Supreme Court in Louisiana, which has passed a statute which gives the death penalty for child rape. And I just don't think it's a wise statute, as much as I have revulsion at even the thought of such a deed. So the problem with the compound, let's be clear. Let me be clear, at least in my eyes. It's not polygamy. People are talking about, oh, polygamy, it's evil, it's wrong, it's immoral. And, you know, I'm not a big fan. The problem is these were children, little girls, forced against their will. And again, statutory rape still should be a crime, but this is far worse than statutory rape. This is true rape. These are little girls being forced against their will into sexual and violent abuse. And yet what's interesting about all of this is that there's a feeling of, well, you know, should they have invaded the compound? Should the troops have gone in and intervened in this religious behavior? Clearly, when a child says that she's being raped, clearly the authorities were right to go in. And it's just fascinating to me that the rape gets so little discussion while the polygamy gets all of the discussion. Doesn't really make any sense to me. Hey, call in. Let's talk about these things. I've got the toll-free numbers, 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We've got Kevin from Brooklyn. Kevin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
Yeah, I think a lot of this has come from the... I think this country has suffered a child fetish in the past 20 or 30 years in many aspects.
What do you mean by a child fetish?
We've over-sexualized our children to a certain degree. You know, when you, Britney Spears has been basically showing her body parts since she was like 14 or 15 years old.
That's probably when she got the implants.
Yeah.
When she was 14 or 15 years old. And of course, it gets younger when I think of, why can't I think of her name?
Montana,
the child in Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
The Ramsey child in Colorado, who at age 4 was put on beauty contests.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's a, and I think it goes, me personally, I think a lot of it goes back to the fundamentalist movement where that was confined to a certain part of the country, but it's become mainstream.
What do you mean by that? I mean, are you talking about the fact that in the South, 50 to 100 years ago, you could get married at 14 and 16, or are you talking about something else?
Probably. You know, I don't want to knock Southerners or anything like that.
Well, I'm just talking, it was a practice. It's certainly true that the age to get married, it's interesting because you find that the South has a higher age of consent and a lower age of marriage. Like, it's okay if you marry your 12-year-old off, but it's not okay if a 17-year-old has premarital sex. So it's kind of inconsistent there. But, I mean, part of it is, look, in ancient societies, you know, the time of marriage was the time of puberty, the time of adolescence. And if you could have sex, then that was sort of the proper time. We've gotten older and older, and at the same time, we're sexualizing children more and more.
Yeah, and, you know, that's what's been, because I've noticed that, like, now, I don't know, maybe this has always gone on, but I think because of mass communication and, you know, cable TV, which was an outlet for, like, the fundamentalist movement, which is primarily from the southern regions of the United States, it has become more mainstream. And again, I don't mean to knock the South, but
I'm just curious,
certain aspects of the Southern culture.
You know, and I'm from Tennessee, so I get a little leeway in knocking the South, even though I'm not, Bob Kincaid's Alabama. But my question is, what do you think fundamentalism in fundamentalism causes this? Is it that fundamentalism is so anti-sex in general that children feel like they have to express this? I mean, I'm trying to get the connection to fundamentalism in your mind.
Well, the thing is, and what a lot of these churches come from that tradition, which condone young girls getting married off at 12, 13 years old.
Yeah.
And
well, that's true, particularly in the backwoods, particularly in the smaller towns that happened, and also marrying them to relatives, which I feel so bad. I feel like I need to have Bob Kincaid here because I feel like I'm talking about West Virginia.
You need to join in on this one.
I feel like I'm talking about his people. But in any case, you know, West Virginia has this stereotype, of course, about incest and young. But, I mean, I think there is some truth in it. There's definitely... partly, I don't know, when you have a rural culture and people aren't living as long, you have people marrying the people they know in small towns, and in some towns, I guess everybody's family. So you have some of that going on. Bob, do you want to have your two cents in here? Because I may just be attacking your people too much here.
Yeah, okay. Bob, please.
Mark... Mark, I'm not angry with you so much as I'm disappointed. Okay? It's okay. No, I got your initial premise, Kevin. The sexualization of our children, and yeah, I've been railing about that for a long time.
There is some truth in what I'm saying. I know it's a stereotype.
Look, go look up the demographics on it, Mark. There are incest cases in all 50 states.
No, I know that.
We don't have the market cornered on them. You know.
But when you talk about young marriages, kids getting married at 14 and 16, and again, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's more than 1% of the population. It's clearly less. But that kind of thing was, particularly 50 years ago, more common in rural places and in the South.
Because it's harder to get into and out of, okay? Thus, you have isolated communities.
Right.
It is said, my dad used to tell me that here in this small town where we live, once upon a time when you walked down the street, if you didn't know a fellow you were about to, you were getting ready to pass on the sidewalk, you said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Skaggs." And if he didn't respond, you said, "Good afternoon, Mr. Kincaid." And he'd say, "Hi." Because it was
there were
one,
only two families in the...
Well, and it is that way in rural America. It's that way in rural Tennessee. It's that way in rural Alabama. It's that way in rural South Dakota. It's that way in rural California. Okay? It's a function
so
it's
rural,
of rurality, not Appalachian-ness or Southern-ness.
All right, I stand corrected. It is a rural issue. Fair enough.
Yeah.
I'll accept.
And I should have said rural America, the mainstreamization of rural America, because rural New Yorker can be, which is, believe it or not, Appalachia, too.
You're darn right it is.
You know.
Rural Western Massachusetts is Appalachia.
Yeah. You know, and
up in the Berkshires. But, Kevin, let me ask you this. When you talk about Britney Spears and her
sexualization, are we all better now?
I think we are. Thanks, Bob, for joining
us. Okay, don't make me pull this thing over.
I'll pull this thing over
and deal with the both of you.
I invited you in because I realized I was on shaky ground.
Give my New York elitism, please.
That's okay. As long as you didn't do it giving a speech in San Francisco, I guess everything's okay.
I knew I was on shaky ground, which is why I invited you in the first place. But Kevin, let me get back to your original issue, which was dealing with Britney Spears. You know, it's funny because I'm of two minds about all this. I mean, I support the sexual liberation of the 60s, and you know, which I think in many ways freed women and also freed just young people in general to pursue their hearts.
Okay, but the thing is, you have to be old enough to understand the responsibilities that comes with.
That's
and
true.
And I don't think most, let's say, assuming that she got her implants around 14 or 15 years old, quite understand the ramifications of that. I think part of the reason why she is drinking and drugging and having this reckless behavior now is because she was basically pimped out as a kid.
You know, that's true, Kevin, but I think Britney Spears knew exactly what she was doing. I mean, don't. It wasn't a good choice. But don't get me wrong. I think she got the implants purposely because she knew that would help her in her music career.
And yeah.
I think it did.
Yeah, and she's a relatively intelligent person.
Right. As a 14-year-old, she said, "I'm going." In other words, she pimped herself out. It wasn't like her family. I think her mother
got encouragement from her family too.
Well, you know, I think anyone that
he as a parent, if God is ever blessing your children, I know, I don't think my 14-year-old anything should be getting any kind of surgery unless it's like a life-saving kind of thing.
Would you ban it?
To me,
Kevin, would you ban it? Would you say that no one under 18 should be allowed to get breast enlargement surgery? Assuming not a medical condition, like breast cancer, where you might want, assuming normal healthy girls, would you ban breast enlargement for a kid under 18?
Probably, because they're not. I think I would.
With their parents' permission and everything? See, it's hard. I wouldn't ban it for people over 18.
Put it this way. As a father, I don't want to know about my daughter's breasts if I had a daughter. I really don't.
I don't know. All these issues, they make me squeamish because while I don't like it,
you're a normal
I don't
human
want
being.
To ever... I'm one that doesn't like to restrict people's freedoms to do really stupid, idiotic things, but I understand there's a difference between adults and children. I mean, certainly adults, if they want to gamble or use drugs that are harming themselves and not harming other people, or get breast enlargement or have a mass orgy, it's if they're adults, it's really none of my business.
Exactly.
The question is about children, and to me, when I look at prepubescent children, then it's, again, an easy question. You look at pre-adolescent and you say any sexual behavior of any sort should be outlawed and punished severely. And then you get to that age between adolescence and 18 where, 17-year-old girls, and I've seen them, right, in high school wearing very low-cut stuff, and that's where I think the classic, child-parent fight starts, right? It's usually around then, or maybe today it could be 15 or 16.
Well,
and I don't know. I mean, the girls want to, and they're expressing themselves, and it's not good for
society. There's expressing yourself, and then there's expressing yourself.
Well, that's true. It's a very hard line.
Yes, teens are naturally curious about sexuality.
Of course.
It's a part of nature. Okay? But in our culture, in our society, though, 18 years old is when that's the threshold we've determined to be an adulthood, even though, to me, the brain is still a child in many ways.
Well, Kevin, let me ask you some tough questions. Okay? Would you... Again, you're a legislator here, all right? So you're looking above it. I'm not talking about your daughter. I'm talking about as a legislature or maybe as a school authority. Would you punish two 17-year-olds for having sex?
Inside the school building, I would have to.
Well, no. No, not inside the school building. Do you think there should be a law or regulation whereby two consenting 17-year-olds shouldn't have sex?
No.
Okay. How about two consenting 16-year-olds?
Well, it depends on the state that I'm living in. I'm going on the...
Well, no. I'm not asking you what the law is. That's easy. I'm asking you what the law should be. That's hard. I'm putting you on the spot. You are a legislator. You can vote on a law that says the age of consent should be 16. Would you vote for it? Would you?
By 16... Pretty much the hormones are kicked in, I think.
Okay. Now, does it make a difference if it's two 16-year-olds or a 16-year-old and a 22-year-old?
No, it's not.
Does it make a difference if it's a 16-year-old and a 50-year-old?
No, because we've determined the age of consent is 16 in whatever locality. It all boils back to age of consent. If we say it's 16 and she is, you know, something's wrong with her where she feels compelled to go with a 50-year-old, then so be it. You know, she's going to have to deal with the consequences of that.
Okay. Now, in the polygamy case, of course, it was a 16-year-old and a 50-year-old. Of course, there was a big difference. The 16-year-old was not consenting and actually called the police. But let's say we have this compound. And again, I'm trying to make things hard on you, so don't be upset if I'm asking if you have a tough time answering the questions. But in this case, you have a girl who lived her entire 16 years of her life in a religious compound where she was told this is the right thing to do. She had never left this compound, this, you know, small, probably hadn't left 1 square mile of this area her entire life, was definitely not exposed to really any ideas of free choice, you know, no TV, really, really cloistered. And she's told she has to marry a 50-year-old relative. Is that consent?
Probably not. Because to me, that comes along the same lines, believe it or not, as someone who has a 2-digit IQ.
Really? Huh, interesting. Someone who's retarded or has borderline.
Not a sound mind to make adult decisions.
But this is a case where a girl is not, genetically or physically unable to make decisions. She's environmentally unable
exactly.
to make those decisions.
And that could be just as bad.
I tell you, these are hard cases for me. Exactly. It is easy when the girl in this case was being forced against her will. I'll tell you the way I like to look at it. And the person who really helped me with this was Congressman Bobby Scott of Virginia, who's a real thinker. He's one of the real intellectuals in Congress, someone who isn't just sort of living day to day and figuring out, but actually thinking about how to design a legal system. And his view was if you're under 18, he used a 4-year age differential. In other words, a 15 and a 19-year-old is okay, but a 15 and a 20-year-old is not. A 16 and a 20-year-old is okay, but a 16 and a 21-year-old is not. It's not a perfect system, but it actually made some sense to me because I'll tell you, even if the age of consent is 16, if two 15-year-olds fool around, I wouldn't want to put either one of them in prison. I mean, I'd want a stern talking to maybe to their parents, but, I certainly would not want to put any of them in juvenile detention. I wouldn't want to embarrass them. I wouldn't even want to find them, bringing them up on court charges. But if it's a 15-year-old and a 21-year-old, well, I can see some problems. And then you start getting to a 50-year-old, and I've got real severe problems. So I kind of liked his idea. I thought it's rough, but in other words, it's not just age that matters, age of consent, whether it be 18 or 16, but age differential in those low ages. And I kind of like the Bobby Scott 4-year rule. 4 years is okay, 5 years isn't. A 14-year-old and an 18-year-old, that's pushing it, but a 14-year-old and a 19-year-old is too much.
To me, a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old, I don't know, but maybe I'm just different, but I know when I was 17 or 18, I would never dream of being bothered with a 14-year-old.
Well, you could imagine a freshman in high school and a senior in high school. I mean, that's what we're
talking
about.
No, not really. When I was in high school, I couldn't. I'm sorry.
Look, I'm not saying it's right. Okay, it's always hard to make a distinction between what's right and wrong and what should be criminal.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that a school could certainly have a stern talking to any 18-year-old who was fooling around with a 14-year-old. But, I look at the case of Gennaro Wilson down in Georgia. I think he was 17 and the girl was 15, so it's not as bad.
Yeah.
But he was put in jail for 10 years in Georgia, and that's way...
I think that was more of a racial issue than anything.
You know, it may have been racial in the sense of who they decided to prosecute. In other words,
exactly.
They didn't go after a white teenager that was a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old. But I got to tell you, when I look at these girls in this compound, what gets me most is not the religious stuff. It's this, and it's very hard to define in the law, but this environmental discrimination, this cloistering, this fact that the girls literally have not, it's almost like they're sitting in an eggshell. and they haven't seen the light of day.
That's going on in my community also, to a certain degree. You know,
people never leave Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, the Lubavitcher Hasidim.
Well, that's true. No question. They live a very cloistered life.
Yeah, and we think this is confined to rural America, and you know, I think you being Jewish, from what I understand.
Oh no, there's no question. The Hasidim lead a very cloistered life, but at least I'm glad to say they're not usually forced into incestuous marriages at young ages.
I don't know about that, because I've seen some very young looking women with these old, decrepit looking.
Yeah, no, I know. No, I've heard of some of those marriages. Usually they're at 18 or 19. I haven't heard of them being 14 or 16.
I sincerely hope so.
But I have a problem in general, I guess, with that. But, you know, at the end of the day, I wonder how much I should be commenting on someone else's choice. It's interesting. I think when we look at the cases of older women and younger men, maybe we're being sexist here, but I don't think many of us feel that sorry. Let's take an easy example. I don't know, a 17-year-old boy and one of those, 34-year-old teacher type cases.
I say good for them, but
but that's sexist, right? I mean, you would feel different if it were a 70-year-old girl and a 34-year-old man, wouldn't you?
Well,
I do. I admit it. I'm sexist.
I admit it too.
I've got less problem with the 17-year-old boy or even the 16-year-old boy, Mrs. Robinson, right? Right out of the graduate, than I do with the older male and the younger girl. Now, is that wrong of me? Am I being sexist? Should people say, Mark?
Well, the thing is, for me, it all boils down to the age of consent. Okay, and that, I'm trying to go by the letter of the law.
But you just said 17-year-old boy. Okay, now, but wait a minute now. 17-year-old boy, 34-year-old teacher, you just said you don't really have a problem with that. That's beneath the age of consent.
I was saying it in a joking manner.
Okay, so you do have a problem with it. Mary Kay LaTourneau should have gone to jail?
I don't think she should have gone to jail, but she deserved to be fired.
Oh, she deserved to be fired. Oh, I'll grant you that. Deserved to be fired. But these are criminal sanctions here. This is more severe than firing.
The thing is, again, in Florida, I believe the age of consent is 17.
In D.C., it's 16, actually.
Okay. And again, it goes down to the state of the age of consent with me on whether it be male, female, female, male, on the relationship age difference. It goes down to the age of consent. If he's a consenting adult, if he's at that age of consent when it happened, then she shouldn't have gone to jail. Period.
Well, yeah, but see, again, it's easy to say, well, people should follow the law. And therefore, you look at the law, the age of consent, and say if people followed it, well, then they're okay. What I'm trying to do is say, look outside that and say, what should the law be? And,
Me personally, I think the age of consent should be raised to 18.
I thought it could be 16. No?
No, universally, I think it should all be raised to 18.
So you think that you could put in jail 17-year-olds for having sex?
If they have sex
them,
with
or,
somebody who's older, well, I don't know.
It's tough. It's tough. This is why I had these discussions with
Scott. It's a biological thing.
Put forward the 4-year rule, which I kind of like. I think it's kind of elegant. I'm going to leave 17-year-olds alone if they're with 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, or 21-year-olds. But if they get to 22, then okay.
It's like, again, people need to govern. And believe you me, I'm no prude, but it's just, there's something about mental competence. And, I know for myself, personally, I don't want to... Well, what the heck? It's been 20-some-odd years. My first time was, 18 years old.
Okay. Well, that's age of consent.
No, it's 19 years, actually.
You're under the age of consent. I don't think they'll come after you now, 20 years.
No, and it was...
limitations has passed.
And the thing is, it's like... Again, any younger, I would have probably had a difficult time dealing with that.
So what is the answer to, let's take away sex for a minute and go back to what you originally called with, which was the sexualization, which is different. You know, Britney Spears and her breast implants, or wearing low-cut clothes, or frankly, the Ramsey child. That by the way, the Ramsey child bothers me far more than Britney
Spears. Yeah.
And far more. I mean, there's just a huge, it's night and day to me. I mean, Britney Spears kind of is gross. The Ramsey child just makes me, I mean, that's just,
Oh, yeah.
To have these kinds of things for a four-year-old, I can't even express how how much revulsion I get with that. But what can you do as a legislator? You can't do much, can you? I mean, I guess a school official could say, sorry, you can't wear that. I mean, one of the things I find interesting is going too far in the other direction. I was reading just in the newspaper the other day about an 8-year-old boy who ran after girls and hugged them and kissed them, and they put the kid in juvenile detention as a sexual harassment policy. I was like, that's way too far in the other direction. That 8-year-old is not trying to have sex with the girls. He's being a bit demonstrative. He can be told to sit in the corner and stop doing that, but I mean, you can go too far in the other direction, too. I don't think that 8-year-old's trying to have sex. I think he's just, let's just say, he just wants attention and to be loved, which we all do. So
yeah.
Maybe not in that extent. I mean, it's tough when you have to legislate around these things.
You know, well, I guess, you know, again, it goes back to a shortcut in thinking. It depends on the case. On cultural mores.
Well, that's true. It definitely depends on cultural mores.
Okay, in a society that is, you know, and I guess mainstream American society, if there's such a thing, I think the age of consent should be universally in every state now, and it should make
it would make things easier. It would certainly make things easier to have it all 18. Although I don't know that 17 or 16, I wouldn't go below 16. But again, depending on the state, with Congressman Scott's 4-year rule. Hey, last question before I let you go, Kevin. Does it make a difference the sex of the people having sex? In other words, whether it's two boys, two girls, a boy and a girl, whether the boy's older, the girl's older, should the law make a distinction?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I don't think it should, and yet something in the back of my mind, and I'm going to admit to my own sexism, something in the back of my mind says that when you got a 34-year-old woman, a 17-year-old boy, I don't know. To me, it just doesn't feel as bad as a 34-year-old man, a 17-year-old girl. And I don't know why. That's, maybe I'm just – I'll admit to my own sexism. I'm not usually sexist, but on that one – I don't feel the same way. But legally, I think you have to. Yeah, you have to make the same rules.
Yeah, and again, it goes back to, again, the age of consent. Period. Whether it be older man, younger woman, or older woman, younger man, it still boils down to the age of consent.
I hear you. Kevin, thanks for your call. This was a very interesting discussion. I didn't know where we were going to go today, but this was a good way to spend most of the show. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate
it. Okay, no problem, my friend.
Again, Kevin raises a lot of good issues, and we went all around the map on it. And part of the reason I asked him these tough questions is because I don't have these answers myself. You know, it's always nice as an interviewer. You can ask all kinds of questions when you yourself don't have the answers. These are tricky issues, and anytime you have an arbitrary line – such as 18, that's going to be, by definition, arbitrary. There are 20-year-olds that shouldn't be having sex, that aren't ready for it. And there are 17-year-olds that are perfectly capable and of having consenting sex, and we should just stay out of their lives. So my real problem when I look at the polygamy case is when I think about how sheltered these girls are, and that's true whether it's the Hasidic community or any number of foreign communities in the United States. I remember I had a Korean-American roommate at Harvard, and his family was very, very, I want to use the right word here because I'm not trying to diss anyone. Let's just say protective. I would say overly protective of their child, and I think part of it is, again, based on culture. In fact, sometimes I think we have these great culture clashes when we have people that move in from other countries. I want to move on, though, and talk about a few other things. We've got the Pope coming to the United States, and that's an interesting thing. And one of the things I find interesting about this Pope is how we really are not supposed to challenge him very much. And I have a lot of respect for the institution. I think that, we can go on and on about the problems of the Catholic Church, both in history and today. But, he should be treated with respect. I certainly understand that. But what does it mean when you have a religion that says a person is infallible? That, to me, is just dangerous. Now, I know Catholics will tell you that he's infallible only when he's sort of speaking in tongues, when he's sort of in his infallible moment, and he's sort of speaking that way. But here you have a so-called infallible man that, when he was 14 or 16 or whatever it was a member of Hitler Youth. Now, I understand it was the law. I understand he was required to do that. I know that the Pope actually even saw some Jews headed to death camps as a teenager. And I'm not saying that the ordinary German should have been expected not to join Hitler Youth to try to stop people from being murdered. I understand that ordinary people normally protect their own lives, protect their own well-being, and don't try to save others when they're going to end up being killed for doing so. I understand that. It's a rational decision. It's not the highest moral decision, but, you know, it wasn't like he perpetrated the crimes. And so it's interesting that most groups, whether they're Jewish groups or anti-Nazi groups, kind of give the Pope a pass. But the man is Pope. And I think he could be held to a higher standard than an ordinary German. I mean, here's the guy that is the spiritual leader of the largest church in the world. There are more Catholics than any other religion in the world. They are the largest sect of Christianity. Christianity has a plurality of adherents across the globe. There are more Catholics than Sunni Muslims or Shia Muslims or any other religious group that you could number, Shinto or Confucianists or whoever. And so I think it's fair. I think it's fair to ask him these questions. Again, I think it's fair to hold him to a higher standard. Now, it's not up to me to hold him to that standard. He's not my Pope. I don't call him infallible. I think he's just a man. So I want to be clear. I'm not saying that I, Mark Levine, have a right to demand anything of this man who is just a man to me. But I would hope that Catholics would. I would hope that Catholics would ask him very detailed questions about his past, partly so that these things are focused on the difficult moral decisions that this man, like millions of Germans, had to make. And maybe it will take some of the sheen off his infallibility, because I don't know, I can understand why ordinary human beings don't risk their life to save lives. But shouldn't a godly being do that? Shouldn't an infallible being do that? So I would hope that Catholics would ask him these questions, not to put down the Pope. I'm not really trying to put him down. I'll put him down for being so against abortion that he's causing tens of millions of children to be born across the world where we don't have enough people to care for them, and for denying birth control to people, and for not allowing priests to marry, which means that we have more pedophile priests around, and for screwing up that part of the church. In other words, I'll go after him for church doctrine, for how harsh they are at gay people, and why is it that women can't be priests. And we can go on and on about church doctrine. That's fair criticism, and I think it's fair to criticize the Pope. But it's for his moral decisions. I would hope some journalist isn't afraid to gently ask the Pope what he remembers, from his teenage years. If only so that we can all understand the difficult moral choices and make him bring him a bit less popish and a bit down to the human being that I think he is. One thing, though, nothing the Pope ever did could compare with what ordinary Americans have done, including, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, a former law school classmate of mine named John Yoo. John Yoo's memo we've talked about frequently in the past. It was the memo that approved not just water torture, but all kinds of torture. And he did so for the worst possible legal reasons. The argument, and get this, it's an incredibly crazy argument. The argument was that the authorization of force resolution, the resolution passed by Congress that said that if Saddam Hussein didn't disarm and didn't allow inspectors in, you know, we would go to war. The resolution that Hillary Clinton voted for, though she says she wouldn't have done it again if she knew now what she knew then. That somehow, that resolution justified our breaking 200 years of American tradition. Of our breaking a human standard that dates back far before the Geneva Conventions of the 1940s, but dates back to another Catholic Pope, the one who led the Spanish Inquisition. And to do so cavalierly, it just came out in the newspaper over the weekend, cavalierly, that President Bush admitted that he personally had approved the torture techniques that he doesn't call torture. Not just water torture or waterboarding, but also holding people in stressed positions. It sounds too nice, euphemistically. Holding people in painful positions. The Inquisition might call it the rack. Putting people in freezing temperatures, which, I'm sorry, reminds me of Nazi experiments. Of not allowing people to sleep for days on end. This kind of, yes, torture, George Bush finally admitted that he did it. And the newspaper printed it, this is the Washington Post, printed it at the bottom of page 3, not at the top of page 3. I suspect most newspapers didn't report it at all. Have we become inured to torture? When Abu Ghraib first happened and we saw those awful, terrible pictures, the administration was quick to suggest these were a few low-level rubes who got out of control. Remember Linda England? The administration didn't authorize that. They argued these are just these people went out of control. And now we know that George Bush authorized worse. After all, putting naked men in a pyramid, not very pleasant. But I'd rather be naked in a pyramid than freezing to death or drowning almost to death or held in a stressed position for days on end. There's humiliation in the naked pyramids, but there's not pain. And yet, my law school classmate, John Yoo, just casually said it's all okay. What are some of the methods that George Bush approved? Open-handed slapping. So that's okay. You can't close a fist, but you can do it open-handed. The threat of live burial was discussed. That one apparently was rejected by some. Well, that's nice. Now, I'm not going to blame all this on John Yoo. John Yoo was doing what he was told. He was just following orders. In a way, frankly, worse than what the Pope did, because I think the Pope would have been punished far more. I don't know. Would he have been? If he hadn't joined Hitler Youth, how much punishment would he have gotten? I don't know. Maybe he wouldn't have gotten into the school of his choice. I doubt he would have been rounded up and been shot. But John Yoo would have lost his job. At the end of the day, though, it's not about him. It's about George Bush and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and Don Rumsfeld. They ordered him to do the memo, and he was just making up law to suit them. And now we have Michael Chertoff, Homeland Security Secretary, who is openly admitting he wants to spy on all of us. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the Bush administration has been spying on all of us for many, many years now. But now that we have a Democratic Congress, a Congress that he's got to try to get approval from, well, he's out there arguing, hey, you know, we need to spy on everybody. It's barely news. It's in the back pages of our newspapers. Have we really come to that? Where torture is old hat? Where an East German totalitarian police state is just a nice back pages of the newspaper? Have we really fallen that far? Apparently we have. Apparently we have. And for all our discussions about children and whether the age of consent should be 18 or 17 or 16, which are fun things to discuss, serious questions of our humanity, of what we allow in the United States of America, of whether or not we are looking to protect people's civil liberties, are going ever so slightly in the directions of the Third Reich. These fundamental questions are not even being debated. Not even being debated. And that, my friends, shows the incredible degradation that we've gotten to over the past 7.5 years. Hopefully, a new president, I'd prefer President Obama, but any president, will never leave us in such a low state again. That's it for this show. I want to talk just briefly tomorrow again, if you're just tuning in. Tomorrow is a show on taxation. We're going to talk about April 15th, all the various taxes in our system, what works, what doesn't work. I have a head of the National Taxpayers Union. She and I are going to have many disagreements. And then Wednesday, this is the real kicker of the week. You won't want to miss Wednesday. Lawrence Wilkerson, Colonel Wilkerson, the chief of staff to Colin Powell, the man who was there from the outset of the Iraq War, will be there to answer my questions, to answer your questions, of how we got into this mess, what people were thinking when they got into this mess, and how we get out. I know you're saying to yourself, what were they possibly thinking? Well, Colonel Wilkerson's going to tell you. I'm really looking forward to him. If you have to miss tomorrow, you could miss tomorrow, but don't you dare miss Wednesday's show. For now, this is Mark Levine, signing off.